Every program that you've ever written or used depends on Malloc, whether you called it directly or not. C uses it, C++ uses it for new. Python, JavaScript, Java, C Sharp, Go, Rust, browsers, games, databases, web servers, device drivers, and probably even the little demon that updates your Sonicare toothbrush all have some version of the same problem. At runtime, they need memory, but they don't know exactly how much ahead of time, and then somebody has to give them a pointer. And that someone is not a magical little wizard. No, Malloc looks magical because the interface is almost offensively simple. You say, I need 37 bytes, and it hands you back an address. That's it. No ceremony. No explanation. Just a pointer to what looks like fresh, empty space. But behind that pointer is one of the most important pieces of plumbing in the entire software world, a memory allocator. Today we're going to build the simplest one possible, but not just in theory, not as a computer science bedtime story. We're going to start with the dumbest allocator you can imagine, the kind you could write on a napkin while waiting for your fries, and then we're going to watch it fail in all the real ways that real allocators have spent the last 40 years trying not to fail. Because while Malloc isn't magic, implementing it is a bit like running a parking garage where every car is a different size, nobody parks in order, and half the drivers leave their keys in somebody else's glove box. The problem that Malloc solves is simple to state and surprisingly hard to solve well. Your program needs chunks of memory of different sizes at different times. One routine wants 24 bytes for a little structure. Another wants 4 megabytes for an image. A parser wants thousands of tiny nodes. A web server requests big buffers, but they only last a few milliseconds. The operating system can give a process memory, but it usually does so in big chunks called pages. And on modern systems, that's commonly 4K pages, though larger page sizes are also available. The OS is very good at mapping pages of virtual address space into your process, but it's not interested in being called every time you need 19 bytes for a string. That would be like driving to Home Depot every time you needed another nail. So Malloc sits in between your program and the operating system. It asks the OS for big regions of memory, and then it carves those regions up into smaller pieces for your code. On Unix-like systems, historically that meant break and S-break to extend the program break, and the modern allocators also use Nmap for larger mappings. On Windows, the C runtime Malloc ultimately gets memory from the Windows heap and virtual memory machinery. The exact details differ, but the shape of the problem is the same everywhere. Get big memory from the OS, hand out little memory to the programs, and somehow keep track of the mess. So let's start with the entire heap just being a big empty array. That's 1 megabyte of fake heap, and our first allocator is almost insultingly small. And there it is. That's a real allocator in the same way that a tarp over a shopping cart is technically a camper. You ask for memory, it gives you the current pointer, and then it moves the pointer forward. And that's called a bump allocator, because allocation is just bumping a pointer. And the first time you see it, there's usually this wonderful little moment where you think, wait, really? That's it? Yeah. In the simplest case, that really is it. And it's fast, absurdly fast. It doesn't search a list, it doesn't lock a mutex, it doesn't split up blocks, it doesn't maintain a tree, it doesn't ask the operating system. It just returns an address and increments a pointer. On a modern CPU, that's barely more than a shrug. This kind of allocator is not just a toy either. Bump allocation shows up in real systems all the time when the lifetime of the memory is simple and well understood. Compilers use arena allocators while parsing. Web servers may allocate per request memory for an arena and then throw the whole arena away when the request completes. Embedded systems use fixed pools where allocation has to be deterministic. Some operating system kernels use region-style allocations during boot because early in boot there may not even be a full heap manager yet. So our little allocator is not stupid because it's simple. It's stupid because it has no answers to what happens next. First, it has no bounds check. Ask it for 2 megabytes from a 1 megabyte heap and it will happily hand you a pointer into tomorrow morning. That's better because it now fails instead of just wandering into the neighbor's yard wearing only a bathrobe. But it still has a subtle problem, alignment. When Malloc returns memory, it has to be suitably aligned for the kind of object you're going to store there. If you allocate a double or a pointer or a SIMD type, the CPU may expect the address to be aligned to 8, 16, or even more bytes. On the x86, unaligned access usually works, but can be slower. On other architectures, it can just fault outright. So a real allocator round sizes up to an alignment boundary. And believe it or not, that was actually the very first question I was asked my first interview on my first morning at Microsoft in my loop. Write a function that returns the next highest multiple of 16. So I even know how to do it. If we align to 16 bytes, asking for 37 actually consumes 48. That extra 11 bytes is internal fragmentation, which is a polite way of saying the allocator took a little bite out of your sandwich to keep the hardware happy. But the biggest problem is that our allocator cannot free anything. We can add a function called free, of course. And congratulations, we have just reinvented the memory leak officially. And that may sound useless, but even this no-op free has legitimate uses when the allocator's lifetime in the arena is that of the whole arena. If you allocate a bunch of stuff while processing a file and then you throw away the entire arena in one go, you never need to free the individual objects. That can be both faster and safer because there's no dangling half-reused heap full of little landmines to unwind. But general-purpose malloc cannot get away with that. In normal programs, objects are born and die in no particular order, so now malloc allocates memory, and free needs to give it back. And this is where the elegant little bump allocator is going to fail hard. The allocator has to remember which parts of the heap are used and which parts are free. But where does it store that information? Well, the answer is usually right next to or in the memory it gives you. A simple little block might look like this. A structure with a pointer and then the number of bytes and then a pointer to the next block. And that header is going to live immediately before the pointer that malloc returns. So when you ask for 100 bytes, the allocator actually reserves enough space for your header plus 100 bytes, maybe rounded up for alignment. It returns a pointer to past the header. To you, it looks like just pure usable memory. But to the allocator, there's a little tag stapled to the front saying how big the block is, whether it's free, and where the next block lives. And this is one of malloc's great little illusions. The pointer you get looks like the beginning of the allocation, but it usually isn't actually the beginning of the block, because there's metadata hiding just before it, like a luggage tag that you're not supposed to notice. Now free becomes possible. When you call free on a pointer, the allocator subtracts the size of the header from P, finds the block metadata, and then marks it free. And that also explains why passing a bad pointer to free is so catastrophic. If you pass a pointer that didn't really come from malloc, the allocator walks backwards from it and tries to interpret whatever random bytes happen to be there as a block header. And if there's one thing that kernel guys taught me, is you don't want to go swimming after somebody has peed in the pool. And if you free the same pointer twice, the allocator may put the same block back into the free list twice. Later, two different calls to malloc may return the same memory to two different parts of your program, and now you've got two owners of the same house, both redecorating the kitchen at the same time. Good luck debugging that one. That's called heap corruption, and it's one of the reasons that C and C++ give you both incredible power and an incredible ability to ruin your weekend. But now our allocator has a free list. When malloc needs memory, it scans the list looking for a free block big enough to satisfy it. That's called first fit if it takes the first suitable block. There's also best fit, which tries to use the smallest block that works, and there are lots of variations. But every strategy is making trade-offs. So suppose our heap looks like this. Used, free, and then used. So you have memory free, plenty of it maybe. But now you ask for a block larger than any individual free gap. You might have 500k free in total, but if it's scattered in 50 little individual blocks, you cannot satisfy a 200k allocation. It's the memory allocator version of having enough floor space in the garage for your motorcycle, except it's distributed across 400 places between paint cans, Christmas decorations, and whatever that weird cable was for. The allocator can fight fragmentation by splitting and coalescing blocks. Splitting means if you have a free 1,000 byte block and somebody asks for 100 bytes, you don't give them the whole 1,000 bytes. You split it into a 100 block byte and a 900 block byte. Coalescing is the opposite, and it means that when a block is freed, you check whether the neighboring blocks are also free on each side, and if so, you merge them back into one larger block. That sounds straightforward until you ask how the allocator knows who the neighbors are. So you can keep blocks in address order, you can store a footer at the end of the block, sometimes called a boundary tag, so you can walk backwards as well as forwards. You can maintain separate lists for free blocks. You can use bins organized by size class. Every little improvement adds metadata, complexity, and another opportunity to get things wrong. And this is why real malloc implementations are not 5 lines long. The 5-line version works right up until the time when reality touches it. Real allocators usually don't keep one giant free list. That would be too slow. If every malloc had to scan thousands of blocks to find just one that fits, your program would spend most of its life doing tiny real estate transactions. Instead, allocators divide memory into size classes. So tiny allocations go into one set of bins, medium allocations go into another, and large allocations may bypass the normal heap entirely and request dedicated virtual memory mappings from the operating system directly. That's because allocation patterns are not random. Programs tend to allocate a lot of objects of the same size. Strings, nodes, buffers, hash table entries, message objects, GUI controls, packets. So if you know that a request is for 64 bytes, you can often satisfy it from a bin of 64 byte chunks without searching the entire heap. This is also the idea behind slab allocators and object pools. If you allocate the same kind of thing over and over, prepare a tray of exactly the kind of thing and stop making the allocator guess. Then come threads. In the old days, a program might be mostly single-threaded and malloc could get away with some relatively simple locking. But modern software has thread pools, async runtimes, background workers, render threads, audio threads, telemetry threads, and 17 things named helper that appear in Task Manager while appearing to do absolutely nothing helpful. If every thread has to grab one global heap lock for every allocation, then malloc effectively becomes like a traffic light in the middle of a freeway interchange. So modern allocators often use per-thread caches or multiple arenas. A thread can allocate small objects from its local cache without contending with every other thread in the process. That's much faster, but it introduces new trade-offs. Memory can become stranded in one thread's cache while another thread really needs it. More arenas can reduce lock contention but increase the total memory footprint. Once again, every solution drags a little wagon of new problems behind it. And then there's security. For many years, heap metadata was a favorite target for exploitation. If an attacker could overflow a buffer and overwrite the allocator's bookkeeping, they might be able to trick free into writing attacker-controlled values to attacker-controlled locations. And that's the sort of bug that turns, oops, I just copied too many bytes, into, oops, now somebody else owns your process. Modern allocators defend themselves with cookies, encoded pointers, guard pages, delayed reuse, quarantines, heap consistency checks, randomized layouts, and debug modes that fill free memory with recognizable patterns. Tools like Address Sanitizer can catch use after free and out of bounds writes by surrounding allocations with poisoned regions. Back in the NT days, we had a special debug allocator that would put hardware guard pages before and after every allocation. It was a ton of overhead to run that build, but it shook a lot of bugs loose. And these tools are wonderful, but they work because they make the memory allocator more suspicious, and suspicion has a cost. And that cost is why your release allocator and your debug allocator may behave very differently. The debug heap allocator is like a building inspector who checks every nail, every joint, and everything. The release heap allocator is trying to get the subdivision built before lunch. There's another misconception worth killing, too, and that is that free does not necessarily give memory back to the operating system right away. Often, it just returns the block to the allocator so it can be reused by your process. So your process's memory usage may not go down in Task Manager just because you've freed a bunch of objects. The allocator may hold on to that memory because it expects that you'll need it again, and giving it back to the OS to only ask for it 10 milliseconds later would be silly. So large allocations are also more likely to be returned because they may have their own page mappings, but small allocations usually stay in the heap's private economy. That's why memory behavior can be surprising. You allocate a million small objects, free them all, but your process still looks fat. It may not be leaking. It may simply have a heap that is now well-stocked with reusable objects. On Windows, the heap manager has evolved through decades of exactly these problems. The low fragmentation heap was introduced to improve behavior for common allocation patterns by grouping allocations into buckets and reducing the kind of fragmentation that made older heaps look like Swiss cheese after a few bad hours. Other platforms have allocators like JEMalloc, TCMalloc, MIMalloc, and HardenMallocs, each tuned for different balances of speed, footprint, scalability, and security. And that's the point. There is no one perfect malloc. There are only trade-offs. If you optimize for raw speed, you may use more memory. If you optimize for low memory footprint, you may spend more CPU cycles searching and coalescing. If you optimize for thread scalability, you may duplicate caches and arenas. If you optimize for security, you may add checks and randomness that cost you time and space. If you optimize for deterministic timing, as in embedded to real-time systems, you may avoid general-purpose malloc entirely in hot paths because unpredictable allocation latency is unacceptable to you. And that all leads to a practical takeaway, which is that the fastest malloc call is the one you do not make. Now, I don't mean you should never allocate memory. That's silly. I mean allocation patterns matter. If you allocate inside a hot loop without thinking about it, you may be pouring sand into the gears of your machinery. If a vector or dynamic array keeps growing one element at a time, reserve the capacity ahead of time when you can. If you allocate millions of tiny objects with the same lifetime, use an arena for them and free them all together. If you allocate the same fixed-size object repeatedly, consider a pool. If you were passing strings around and copying them three times because the abstraction diagram looked better that way, maybe the machine is trying to tell you something. And profile before you get religious about it. Malloc is often not the bottleneck. Modern allocators are actually very good, but when allocation is the bottleneck, it can be spectacularly bad because it's not just the allocator cost. It's the cache misses, the fragmentation, it's memory bandwidth, it's lock contention, it's TLB pressure, it's destructors and constructors and zeroing and page faults and all the invisible machinery that wakes up because you asked for another tiny object in the wrong place. The real lesson is not that malloc is bad. Malloc is one of the great enabling hacks in software history. It lets static programs adapt dynamically at runtime. It lets data structures grow. It lets code handle the world as it is instead of the world the programmer guessed about at compile time. But malloc is not magic. It starts as a pointer into a big empty array. Then you add bounds checks, then alignment, then headers, then free lists, then splitting, then coalescing, and then bins, then larger allocation paths, then locks, then thread caches, then arenas, then security hardening, and then debug modes, and then tools to help you find all the ways that you've been using it wrong. And by the time you're done, Malloc has become a tiny little operating system inside your process, managing a private city of blocks and pages and alleys and abandoned warehouses. Most of the time, it works so well that you never think about it, which is exactly the kind of engineering we tend to undervalue, the engineering that disappears when it's done right. So the next time you write Malloc 128 and get back a pointer, remember what just happened. A little bookkeeper found a place in your process's private universe, made sure it was aligned, recorded its size, hit an ID tag in front of it, maybe split up a larger block, maybe pulled a thread from the thread cache, maybe asked the OS for new pages, and then handed you an address with the quiet confidence of a parent who knows that you're absolutely going to write past the end of it someday anyway. And when you call free, it will take that memory back, mark it as available, maybe merge it with its neighbors, maybe hold it for reuse, maybe return it to the OS, and then sit there quietly hoping you don't touch that pointer again. So Malloc isn't magic. It's bookkeeping plus 40 years of people fixing all the ways that the bookkeeping can go wrong. If you found today's episode interesting or entertaining, remember I'm mostly in this for the subs and likes, so I'd be honored if you consider leaving me one of each before you go today. And if you have a good question, please post it in the comments with a question mark. We answer all the best ones every Friday on Shop Talk, and I'll put a link to one episode here so you can check it out. Go over there and give it a subscription as well if you like it. Thanks, and in the meantime and in between time, I'll see you next time, right here in Dave's Garage.
Do it, Glenn! Do it!